Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Loosehead podcast with me, Jeff Neville. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to have Ben Ryan on the phone. Ben, how are you getting on?
Doing really well, thanks. Sun is shining in West London.
I imagine the last couple of months has given you time to sit back, reflect, work on some projects and make some time for yourself.
That's it, actually. It's been quite nice to have this time to not be on the road. And like you say, that the projects that you've always been wanting to do but just haven't managed to find the time. I've managed to get my head around some of those, so it's been good.
Well, I wanted to talk to you today about the Fiji experience you had, but mostly about coaching at the highest level and that peak performance and everything like that. So I suppose if you're ready, we'll just jump right in.
Yeah, definitely.
So first off, you applied, interviewed for, and accepted the Fiji job all in a very short time frame. What was it that encouraged you to step out of your comfort zone like that?
It's a good question. Yeah, no, it was a bizarre set of events that got me across to Fiji. But I guess if I reverse a little bit, the last year that I had been coaching England Sevens was not an enjoyable one. You know, I'd kind of fallen out of love with professional rugby, and a lot of the extra stuff and the extra layers of management, decision making and bureaucracy that came with the elite sport. And I was forgetting about why I was involved in it in the first place, which was trying to get, a bit like I was when I was a teacher, trying to get the best out of everybody and create an environment where people can thrive. And I'd had big arguments with my bosses at Twickenham. We had very different outlooks on what we wanted the game to look like and how we wanted to plan. And it was the World Cup final in Russia, where we just got to the final for the first time in a couple of decades. And I didn't really want to be there, didn't really enjoy the final whistle going from the semi-final to get into the final. Remember finishing, losing to New Zealand, just wanted to go home and think of something else to do. And then Fiji turned up via somebody sending me a tweet saying Fiji are looking for a new coach, and that got the ball rolling.
How alien was it living in Fiji to begin with? But how important was living there when it came to getting to know your players as people, their daily habits and lifestyle?
Yeah, firstly, I wasn't living like a spoilt lifestyle in London. But, you know, you had a bit of money from your work and you lived in a nice part of town and you had a job that was, you know, that from the outside anyway was exciting. And then I went to Fiji and I didn't bring any staff with me. So it was just me and Fijian staff. And I didn't want to live in the capital. I'd been in contact with a couple of people when I knew I was going to get a job. And one of them ran a backpackers in Pacific Harbour and was really keen on the rugby. So I went to Pacific Harbour and I based myself there. I really felt very nervous in those first few weeks. You really didn't know which way to turn and what to do. But I needed to do that. I needed to have a reset button. And I knew I was a much better coach than perhaps I'd been in that last year with England. And Fiji kind of gave me the opportunity to have a brand new, fresh start, really.
You said you went over without any other coaches. And there's a quote in the book that I really liked. You were trying to get guys running at top speed to measure them. And without spoiling what happens in the book, because I'm sure you want people to read it, the key ingredient was simply a ball. And the quote was that you said you were a man up a creek trying to use a laptop as a paddle.
Yeah. No, Jeff, carry on. You're right. It's that. I talk about it a lot when I'm doing various things in business and work, that when you start off on your career, and I don't just mean coaching, you know, it might be when you're a teacher or you're a startup company or whatever it is, you start fairly close to the bottom, and you don't have too much that you're in charge of, but you are in control of everything that you're doing. And I use the analogy that, you know, I started off my coaching and my teaching with like I was on a bicycle. It's not a flash bicycle. It doesn't have many gears. It's probably a bit rusty, but I can be on it and I can decide where it goes. And avoid hitting things in the road. And as you move through professional sport, you become more, that bicycle turns into something bigger until I get to Twickenham and the RFU, and it was this big juggernaut that went really fast, and I was at the back of that juggernaut and had no control over anything. And with that, sometimes you get all this noise around professional sport, you know. And I had a name for bringing in innovation in England. And it wasn't really particularly because I was geeky about that sort of stuff. It was just because I was setting up a sevens program that needed to know more. I needed to know what was required of these physically, these athletes. And Clive Woodward had some GPS that he'd used with a test team. And after a couple of sessions, they decided they didn't want to use him. So I took them and put them on the sevens boys. And we were the first rugby team to use them in international matches and all that tech and everything else. And at Twickenham, it was, you know, medical staff higher up that weren't even coming to training, telling me how many minutes I could do contact every week, and administrators telling me, you know, how to run the team that would never come to actually watch the team train or play. And you get in that mindset sometimes that you lose the basics and the foundations. And so, yeah, so when I went to Fiji with an all Fijian staff, and I'm just doing something simple like a 40-meter sprint test that would, back in England, would be done on, you know, the best surfaces with the best technology wrapped around it to give them feedback to how they could improve their speeds and get better. I didn't have any of that in Fiji, but the boys just thought, you know, what's he doing getting us to run from a coconut tree to a plastic bag that I'd put 40 meters away, because, you know, it's not fun, not getting fitter, you're not scoring tries. And when my physio told me to put give someone in front of them, someone to chase, they suddenly got faster because there was a reason to do it. And I guess the long final, the end of this story, I suppose, is that whenever I did anything with them, and anything I do now with any organization, even if it's a, you know, a multi-million pound organization playing Premier League football, you have to say what you're doing and explain why you're doing it so that players connect to that, and then they understand it and they own it. And with Fiji, I had to do exactly the same. And that example you gave me was a really good one of, I didn't explain it, I just thought they'd understand it. And so it kind of just got me back to basics with Fiji, which I've hopefully is something that I've not forgotten now.
So do you think in the modern game that there's too much of a focus on the need for the latest technology and numbers and statistics?
I do. And, you know, I came through as an amateur and then a professional as a player. I was that first group of players when the game went pro, where we suddenly had more time on our hands and nobody really knew what to do. And so we'd go to the gym and drink more cups of tea, and these playbooks would slowly get thicker for no other reason than the coaches had a bit more time on their hands. And I stand by the sentence that I often say, that thicker playbooks equals thicker players. And you often can just get too much noise in a program and actually not understand the signal and what's really important. And when I'm going to work, some of the work I'm doing in consultancies in different sports that have much more money than a lot of the professional rugby teams have, they've now come full circle and they realize that all that added stuff, how much of a difference is it really making? And, you know, ultimately, you're playing football, you're wearing a black shirt, you're trying to kick it to other people in the black shirt. When you haven't got the ball, you're trying to get it off people in the white shirt opposite you. And we lose focus sometimes that the games that we play are far more simpler. And, you know, asking yourself a question with all the technology, all the noise, all the people that you involve, you know, is it going to make us better? And with Fiji, with no money and no very little resource except the human resource, which was the wonderful players, you had to ask those hard questions. And I've just, again, it's something that I did have as a young coach. I kind of forgot about it when I was at Twickenham a bit, and it resurrected itself and remained when I went to Fiji.
I do think the simpler the game and the more clear the picture of what a coach is trying to achieve, the more fun players tend to have as well.
Jeff, what I think is, for any, how I set up a team now is have clear black and white boundaries, guardrails on what's required. So if that's on the playing field, you know, you have your clear guardrails on your non-negotiables, on what everybody's agreed. And then within those guardrails, you allow players to make their own decisions, to communicate on what they're seeing as the game's unfolding, and to be more flexible in their in the way that they play. You know, now for me, that's going to get a good team to be a great team. You can have a highly organized six phase plus team, defense very, very rigid, and you drill them to bits. For me, I love playing against those teams because ultimately it's harder for them to find their plan Bs, because even if they've got players in those teams that are very good and creative, if they've been shoved into playing a very a drilled game, then it's a lot harder for them to relearn those skills on making decisions on the hoof. And you know, you can find a plan to outplay and outthink those teams by not doing too much sometimes to take them away from their plan. So, yeah, I'm a big proponent of allowing players to feel autonomy, which drives their belief and their purpose. And I think it just gets you into that higher level of success than you would get if you were trying to be overly scripted.
Looking at some of the players, and you selected some probably against the advice of some higher up, standout traits have you consistently seen in young players who have made it to the top?
Great question. I think two parts. Yeah, I did pick players that I was told not to. And I'm very much a case of when someone comes in, it's not like sometimes when you're going through as a player, someone's coming into the academy or junior, or you're starting up in the first team, and you're right there, you know, you're at the front of the bus and you're treated as the lowest person in the team. You know, everybody that comes in, I give them an A star to start with, and it's up to them to hang on to that. And so I didn't care if I was told a player was a troublemaker or was this or was that. You know, it's what you see, and it's, you know, and often it's, you know, it's the difference between those 6 inches between what people hear and the couple of inches on looking ahead and what you see can make a big difference on those first moments on judging players and allowing them to show you who they are. And I would say that if I had to have some traits where the great players that I've coached, they have a freedom to do what they want to do, so they feel safe in their skills and their communication, that whatever the coach has decided to put in front of them as a blueprint to play the game, they will still be confident enough to do their thing and make their decisions and back themselves. And I think in nearly every exception, I've had a couple of players like a Jerry Tuwai in sevens that's taken time to get to this, but being incredibly hard workers and wanting to hone their skill and master it. It's been a common thread I've seen with the very best players that I've worked with.
Even when things got difficult, was it tough to keep the faith in the process?
Yeah, it was and it wasn't. I had a military dictator and a convicted murderer as my two line managers that made things difficult, and that you're in charge of a program that it's the country's national sport. So there was a lot of pressure on there from an external, but and occasionally, you know, you lose one game or two games in a row, you know, that they'd often be calling for the coach's head. But if you stick into your process, and I had clearly got alignment from staff and players, and also then made sure that message went to the media and to the supporters, that this is the journey and this is the process we're on, that my side of the bargain, I was always going to keep up. And I guess one of the things that always helped me was whenever I walked onto the field, however bad I felt, however much pressure I felt under, when I went on the field to coach the team, there was so much joy in the training sessions that we had that it lifted your spirits and those around you. So you never held on to anything for very long working and coaching with the Fijian team.
Across any level, any coach and any player will say, when you lose, people think you're useless. But when you win, they're very quick to tell you what you still could have done better. How important is it for coaches and players of any level to block out that noise?
It's one of the things that I don't think you can read in a book or do on a coaching course. It comes from experience, and you know, I learned from experience how to deal with and manage my ego, and that's effectively what we're talking about here. You know, if you're winning, then you think you're you know, you're the main man and everything's down to you, and you think you're way better than you actually are, and you've had more of an influence on the game than was ever really possible. And if you don't do well, then you're looking for other people to blame. You drive people outside what's been agreed, and you don't have a consistent behavior. And I think parking your ego as a coach is a really hard skill, but it allows you to be far more free thinking and make decisions based on actually what's best for everybody, for the environment, for the team, not something that your ego is telling you that you need to say or do or feel because it's getting to the front and center of things. So, you know, I've had lots of work that I've done myself to make sure that that ego gets parked, and, you know, occasionally it will rise up, and you've just got to remind yourself that it doesn't do you any good, and to get back to your processes.
There was a line in the book as well that you repeated constantly, and it was, the standards we walk past are the standards we become.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that that almost became the culture of the team. How important is it for a team to have an identity and a culture that everyone buys into?
I'm getting into a lot of trouble at the moment with the standard you walk past, because we'll be going for walks on the river where we are here, and I'll be seeing people that are not observing social distancing or are going one way systems the wrong way, and I'll be asking them to picking them up on that, and I feel like I'm the local policeman that's telling them all of these things. But what I guess I use that sentence a lot for is because I've come across lots of cultures and environments where they will have all those, their values or their beliefs or their vision stuck on the wall about this is who we are. And, you know, and when they're playing a big home game, you might see some of their players having a broom and cleaning out their change rooms after the game, but you won't see them on the road when they're doing that in an away game, or if they've just lost and they didn't live their values. They don't have a value system that actually can be consistently applied and seen. And that's where I use the phrase, you know, the standard you walk past is the standard that you become, because if you see someone doing something that's outside what we've all agreed is the way we should behave, and you don't pick it up, you don't say anything about it, then that becomes your standard and that becomes the team's standard. And we always would use a really simple, going back to that 40-meter sprint, connecting values, everything, you have to connect to behaviors. You know, we'd always say that if we didn't win Olympic gold medal with Fiji, it's not because Oscar Kalinasau, the captain, would miss a tackle in the final, or Jerry Tuai would miss a conversion. It would be because of someone's behaviors 6 months earlier. And if people understand that everything connects, then you're going to get much better, consistent behaviors, and you're going to get a self-policing group that means that the head coach isn't the one having to pick up on people on a daily basis. It's being regulated and run by those players and the people that are working in that group, and they're feeling then that autonomy that I talked about, and that they're actually making a difference themselves. They're not part of a bigger machine where they don't have any say in how they can direct the success of that group.
The last question I want to ask about your time with Fiji, could you pick out one standout moment when you began to see or realize your plan was coming to fruition?
Two, an on-field and an off-field one. An on-field one was when, I was working a lot on some of their foundation stones, and one of them was, you know, we didn't want any breakdowns in the way that Fiji played, but if we ever went into breakdowns or defensively in the counter rucking, we wanted those to be absolutely golden. And so we worked hard on the tactics and the technique really around the first man and second man into those breakdowns in attack and defense. And I did a session one on a Monday, and then it was in the evening. I came home and I got out early to the training ground in the morning, and they were already out there. And they were coaching themselves the tactics and the skills that I had given them the day before. And that was for me a very big moment, because for the first few months, first year really, they just wanted to wait to see what I did. You know, the white guy in charge, whatever he said went, they would just repeat that, do that, and nothing more. And actually they realized there that they've been given these tools that they then can use and adapt and do use themselves. And so for me, that really felt that we were on the right track. And then after tournaments, I'd let the boys, I didn't want them drinking. I wanted everyone to stay together, and we were being pretty tight on their nutrition. So I'd let them go to have anything that they wanted. And they'd always go for KFC. KFC is banned in Fiji. The story goes that the prime minister, who is the military dictator, Frankie, he went into the KFC in Suva and said, "I'd like to know what your secret herbs and spices are." And KFC said, "We're not going to tell you." So they shut down every KFC overnight, and they're still not there. So when a Fijian's overseas, KFC is your go-to. And we'd go to a KFC after a tournament. I'd buy them all with bargain buckets, and we'd sit down and eat and have a little chat. And often you'd get the Kiwis and Samoans and Australians and South Africans would be sneaking out behind their coaches' backs and doing the same. And we got to about a year to go before the Olympics, and I did the same in New Zealand, and said go to a KFC, and half the boys said, "Do you mind if we just eat in the hotel and have the salad there? You know, it's a bit greasy, the KFC." And I thought, well, we're onto something here. If I can get those Fijian boys off KFC after a hard tournament, then they're really starting to understand the connection between eating well and being consistent in their performances.
I know I said that was the last question about Fiji, but I'm afraid I lied a little bit then there. I really want to ask, you coached Fiji to an Olympic gold medal. How good a feeling was it to finally do that? And the second question I want to ask is, was it difficult to adapt to life after achieving such a big goal?
The feeling I got, I've got to say that without sounding like my ego's getting involved, it's a genuine feeling I had very early on that we were going to win the gold medal. And we had talented players, but they'd won one World Series in 2005 when they had arguably the two best sevens players ever to play the game, William Ryder and Waisali Serevi playing, and they hadn't won anything since then on the world stage as far as a series. But I knew we had the quality, and then I knew we'd got them to the fittest levels they'd ever got to the Olympics. I knew that they also, the way we wanted to play was total alignment. And so I felt very confident on the sideline that the boys were very highly competent. And luckily, by half time, it was 29 something. So I had that 10 minutes of that second half to enjoy it really. And I felt a huge wave of relief that we had achieved what we set out to do. And I knew that it would change everybody's lives. So that was kind of my overriding feelings. I didn't have any beers that night because I was knackered and went to bed and slept amazingly well. And afterwards, for the next 3 or 4 months, I went to work in New York in basketball for a while. And I did have a drop. I did find it hard to find a what next. I got told by mates that had achieved other things like that you'll be a bit of a dick once the Olympics are over, and you'll think you're better than you are. You'll get carried away. You'll party more than you should do, drink more than you should do, and I did. And I was in New York, and I was working with some pretty cool organizations, and I dropped back into that kind of not a great version of me. And then after a few months, I came back out of it and I kind of recalibrated it. And I think it's difficult when anybody, you hear that phrase, I think Bernard Jackman talked about it, athletes die twice, and coaches sometimes as well, after they have something that they've worked to achieve, after that, things seem very mundane. And so it's difficult, to manage those highs and lows.
How important is it to continue to change and adapt your game, especially when you're on top?
I think what's important for me, and it's not as easy to do either for coaches coming through, is not just settle for best practice being what you're seeing happening at the top. Be curious on, there's different ways to play the game, to coach the game, to push technique, to push tactics. And I think, if you base all of that on really good, clear, black and white guardrails within your program, you plan really well, and your foundation stones around your core skills, which include decision making, and your training principles, and then everything off field as far as your values and behaviors, you should feel as a coach then comfortable to really try to push things and try things. And if those are communicated well to the players, then I think that's how you're going to get some innovation that's actually going to help you and get you better. And, you know, I was lucky. I've had some really good mentors like Brian Ashton when I was younger. And I always didn't feel scared to try things. So when I was coaching 15s, you know, I'd pick a libero often. And we were only playing at Championship, so level below the Premiership, but still a good standard, playing teams like Northampton and Harlequins that had got relegated in those years. And I'd pick 14 players, then one player that I just said, go wherever you fancy. And no one's done it since. But actually, it worked pretty well for us. And it just allowed them, it kind of reinforced the fact that I would allow players to have that autonomy within what we're trying to achieve. And I think there's lots of different things that you can do to push things. And sometimes we get caught up in just wanting to do what we see at the very top. And that's not always best practice.
So would you say that open-mindedness is probably one of the most important things to have?
Definitely. You know, you're learning all the time. It doesn't matter who it is. There's nuggets of gold to be learned everywhere, really. I think, you know, how I see it is you don't want to be that coach that's a bit of a magpie, you know, sees something glittery and goes to that, and then the next week goes to something else. Have your core principles that you're not going to move from, you know, things that you think are absolutely vital. But around that, there's stuff that you know that you should be continually to improving all the time and looking for other ways to do things. And that's where your curiosity, your open-mindedness can really help you and drive those coaches to be better or fulfill their promise, rather than get stuck in a fixed mindset where there is only one way or two ways to do something.
Are there elements of other teams or individual athletes that you have tried to implement or would look to use as inspiration for the teams?
Yeah,
you coach?
There are actually. I mean, on and off field. And I think we all can be accused of a bit of plagiarism with lots of things we see. And you might see something from another sport or even another sector and see how that could work for you. And so, you know, I use some of my movement and passing practices I've taken from a Barcelona academy practices that they do, and it's with a football and you can pass it back and forwards, but I've modified it to do it with a rugby ball and within the laws of the game to encourage movement, communication and decision making. And so that, I guess, that there's some crossover from that. Formations that football will use, whether there's Inverting the Pyramid is a brilliant book for any coach. It's the history of football formations, and you don't have to like football. It just gives you good insight into why things have changed and the reasons that coaches have tried to change stuff to gain an advantage. And, you know, I use backline formations that wouldn't have a typical back formation. I'd have a lot of stuff to put some real pressure and questions on the defence to move their shapes. And that stuff all, I guess, I've got a bit from me and a bit from other sports. And then obviously on and off the field stuff, you steal. I think I remember stealing some questionnaire stuff, wellness stuff from America's Cup, and to keep that whenever you're looking for certain things and you go delving into trying to find out. I remember looking at how to beat jet lag and circadian rhythm stuff for our travel, and I talked to people that worked in orchestras, because, you know, these orchestras go from London to Sydney, and then they land and they suddenly got to play in front of a packed audience, and they're absolutely on point. And I thought, well, I'd like to know how they managed to do that and have their fine motor skills absolutely honed to perfection, and their decision making having had all that travel. So you do, if you're open-minded, then it leads you into some really interesting conversations.
Are there any non-negotiables regardless of the culture or team you walk into?
There are. And I think what people have to be careful of is it's not a polar opposite. If you're saying you're a coach that really wants players to make decisions and to be more autonomous and to drive things, it doesn't suddenly mean that you're just some sort of hippie coach that's decided that you're just going to let the lads run free. What you need is to have very clear, so my non-negotiables are very clear guardrails, agreed guardrails with coaches, with the other players and coaches, on what our standards are for everything and what we're trying to do. And within those guardrails, so if you imagine a box, within the outside of those that box is guardrails. Inside of that, you're allowing people to be their best version. You know, they're doing things that they want to do to be their best, whether that's how different methods of training or recovery or communication to get their belief and purpose, feel safe in having good conversations with people and not getting not feeling that the coaches are gonna put a big black mark against their name, feeling that they've got some status, their achievements are getting recognized, all that sort of stuff. But those non-negotiables, occasionally players are going to make mistakes and break those non-negotiables, those guidelines, those guardrails. And when the guardrails are broken, you've got to be, as a coach, can't protect someone from the consequences of their actions. So you can put an arm around someone and you can help them manage that, but you're not going to say, oh, well, look, he's our star player. I know he went out drinking when he shouldn't have done, but really need him on Saturday. So let's just have a quick word with him. Tell him he's been a naughty boy. Don't do it again and get him on the field. If you do that, that's your standard for everybody. You've got grey in the system. If you've got grey, then you've got fog. If you've got fog, then you don't know where you're going. And as a young coach, I definitely was guilty of that. I wanted the players to like me, wanted the players to love me. So you give them a bit too much rope. You kind of give them too many second chances that are outside what everybody's agreed. And when you do that, your system is not gonna work. So I've learned the hard way that they become your non-negotiables, and you have to play the long game. And I see it a lot in football, you know, where a new coach comes in. You know, it's often the old coach has often been sacked because the culture's started to tip the wrong way. The new coach comes in, the star players aren't behaving themselves, but he turns a blind eye because he needs his first game to get 3 points. And, you know, a month down the line, those star players that aren't doing what they're doing are the ones that are getting that guy sacked again or in trouble because he hasn't set his standards early enough. So they'd be, you know, they're absolutely on my non-negotiables.
Just talking about football there, do you think player power is a problem in rugby or will become a problem in rugby?
In football, it's difficult. You know, I think, you know, I had this preconceived thoughts around football, you know, that I thought rugby did everything better. We had better standards. We had better brains trust in the management, the coaches. Our sports science knew how to do things better. And football, really, they had all the money, but they weren't as adept at performing and high performance as rugby. And I was totally wrong. You know, I'm not saying rugby are doing it wrong, but football do it brilliantly well in many places that I've gone to. And it's very hard for them, where in rugby, generally, you go into a team, there's only, you know, national teams are easy. Most of the time, you've only got one culture and one language. And in professional teams in rugby, even in some of the more multicultural premiership teams in England, you probably still only got a couple of different languages, three maybe at most. Football's totally different. Even my local club, Brentford, in Championship, I think they've got over 20 different nationalities in the match day squad and in the A team and B team. And so coaches have got to be very clever and skillful at managing the players, so that plus these players are on £500,000 a week. Now, for rugby, we don't have any of those problems. There's some top players that are paid a lot of money now. But generally, I think we have a system in place where they haven't got that money. It's not as complicated, the landscape, as far as so many different cultures to understand. There's no excuse, really, for players breaking those guardrails and coaches breaking those guardrails. So I don't think we'll ever get to the point. But I think football is a very difficult. I mean, somebody gets that right in football, and you show a Jurgen Klopp or Pep Guardiola, they are absolutely, you know, the geniuses at their man management. I've seen Guardiola talking 4 different languages to his back 4 and his goalkeeper fluently. No, we haven't got many rugby coaches that would be able to do that.
The last question I'll ask you, and it's one I like to ask all coaches when they're on the podcast, is, regardless of level, what advice would you give to a coach?
Well, the advice I'd give is get your hours in. So get as many experiences, as many opportunities as a coach coming through the systems to coach. So I remember when I was moving through, I was a PE teacher and coaching my school team. I was coaching the county under 18s. I was coaching Oxfordshire under Oxford Junior under 21s, Southwest Schools. I was coaching Newbury. I was coaching a couple of other invitation teams, and I submerged myself really in it because there's nothing. I talked about it earlier, but you can. I don't really read rugby books as far as coaching manuals and everything like that. But your coaching courses, to a large extent, tick boxes and get you to a certain standard. But it's experience that gives you the knowledge to be better. And so just do as much as you possibly can, and don't think that you can't get some absolute great pieces of information from a PE rugby coach that's been coaching for 20 years at a local school. He or she could have just as much cracking information as the academy coach. And often those young coaches try to network with the people that are the professional clubs rather than actually do the hard yards to get better at their skill, their trade, so that they've got those experiences that will get them the better jobs and will move them through and they will be more successful.
Well, Ben, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to come on the podcast and for talking about everything so well and so openly.
No, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for some cracking questions.
Thank you very much. And I'll let you get back to your day. Folks, that's it from me. Thanks a million for listening.